You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. And now here's Pastor Sandy in Matthew chapter 24.
In 1947, shortly after World War II, a group of scientists inspired by Albert Einstein established what's called the Doomsday Clock. Its purpose is to tell us how close we are to that catastrophic destruction, the extinguishing of the human race, the figurative midnight. Over the last 40 years, the Doomsday Clock has been as close as 2 minutes to midnight. That occurred in 1953 after the United States successfully tested the first hydrogen bomb. The furthest from midnight the clock has been set is 11:43, 17 minutes from midnight. That moment of euphoria was reached in 1991 after the fall of the Soviet Union. The most recent change occurred in January of last year. We're now at 11:55 p.m. With 26,000 armed nuclear warheads, with North Korea and Iran's quest for nuclear arms, with the natural disasters that seem to be sweeping our planet, we are now just 5 minutes to midnight. And as I read my Bible, I'm drawn to the same conclusion. Our world is in its final days, what the Bible calls the last days. In fact, 11:55 may be a generous appraisal. But here's where I disagree. The earth is not headed for annihilation. Before we destroy ourselves, before we ever were to destroy ourselves, Jesus will intervene. God has plans for this earth. He has plans for mankind. And Jesus has promised that He will rescue this fallen planet from itself and on it establish His glorious kingdom. This is what Jesus talked about with His disciples in Matthew chapter 24. Verse 1, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple. Now, it's still Monday in Jesus' final week. It was a busy day for Jesus, and it was an infamous day for Israel. It was the day that decided the nation's destiny. The day before, the people had cheered Jesus and had hailed Him their Messiah as He rode His donkey down this same mountain into the city. But the Jewish leaders didn't share their sentiment. This was why Jesus had cursed the fig tree, a symbol of the nation. Israel itself had been cursed. A lot had happened that day in the temple. Jesus had avoided the theological traps thrown at Him. He had launched a fiery tirade, torching the Jewish hierarchy for their hypocrisy. When He had left the temple that day, the die had been cast in Israel's future. Judgment now was only a matter of time. The fig tree, in essence, had begun to wither. And as Jesus leaves Jerusalem and the temple, He heads east toward Lazarus' house in Bethany. He and his men cross a narrow valley called the Kidron Valley. Just beyond, He leaves the Temple Mount. He crosses the Kidron Valley moving east. He climbs up to the top of the Mount of Olives. On our tours to Israel, the best, the most panoramic view of Jerusalem is always from the top of the Mount of Olives. Usually what happens is the bus driver makes you close your eyes until you get right around to the edge of the Mount of Olives, and then he has everybody open their eyes all at once, and there stretched out before you is the classic scene, the holy city of Jerusalem. From the top of the Mount of Olives, you're 150 feet above the city. From there, every photo becomes a postcard. And it was from the top of Olivet that Jesus, remember, at the end of chapter 23, He wept. He said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I wanted to gather you under my wings as a mother hen gathers her chicks, but you were not willing." How it broke His heart that the people of Israel, God's people, had rejected Him as their Messiah. And Jesus predicted that the house of Israel would become desolate. And He elaborates on this prediction in chapter 24. And His disciples came up to show Him the buildings of the temple. Now, the disciples were Jews, and of course, it had been a rough day for Judaism. Suddenly, their patriotic pride sort of rises up, and they say, "Oh Lord, not all is wrong with our religion and our nation. My, look at our temple. It's majestic. It's beautiful. And indeed it was. The temple, you see, had been built by Zerubbabel and had been renovated by King Herod. Herod's refurbishing efforts had taken 46 years. He'd invested vast wealth and effort to transform the temple into one of the wonders of the ancient world. Listen to how Josephus describes the temple in the first century. The exterior of the building lacked nothing. It astounded both mind and eye. For, being covered on all sides with massive plates of gold, the sun was no sooner up than it radiated so fiery a flash that persons straining to look at it were compelled to avert their eyes as from the solar rays. To approaching strangers, it appeared from a distance like a snow-clad mountain, for all that was not overlaid with gold was purest white. Josephus also mentions that some of the stones that were used to build the temple were enormous, the size of a railroad boxcar. Here's some of those same stones. You can see from the guy all the way up the top, all the way down to the end, that was one huge stone. The temple was an impressive source of pride for the Jewish people. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things?" He's pointing out to the temple before him. "Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." In other words, your source of pride, he says to the disciples, is about to be pulled down and pillaged. It was 40 years later, in 70 AD, when General Titus Vespasian brought his Roman legions to Jerusalem to put down a Jewish revolt. Even though a few Jewish dissidents were held up inside the temple, the general ordered the troops to preserve the temple, to not attack the temple. As a matter of fact, there's a picture in Rome of it's on the Arch of Titus that actually commemorates his victory of Jerusalem and the Romans carrying back to Rome a lot of the temple treasures. But it's interesting. Although the general ordered his soldiers to preserve the temple, one of Titus's soldiers, he got trigger happy. And rather than being patient, rather than waiting, he disobeyed his orders. And he threw a torch into the compound. As the buildings began to burn, the heat became so intense that those gold plates that Josephus had written about, they melted. And the liquid gold ran down into the crevices between the stones. The greedy Roman soldiers, they pulled down every single stone in an attempt to retrieve the gold, thus fulfilling Jesus' words that not one stone shall be left upon another. On our tours to the Temple Mount, you can see these very same stones right there at the bottom of the mount. These were the stones that Jesus talked about that would be pulled down, that not one stone would be left upon another. You can go there today and see the fulfillment of this prophecy. In the end, Judaism had no reason to boast. She was bankrupt spiritually, and God was about to foreclose on her hypocrisy. Verse 3 tells us, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives," you know, it's interesting that the Mount of Olives not only figured prominently into Jesus' first coming to earth, but it would also be the center of his second coming. In Zechariah 14, verse 4, we're told that when Jesus returns to punish his enemies and establish his kingdom, where is he going to touch down first? He's going to set his foot down right on the top of the Mount of Olives. Remember when Jesus ascended to heaven, he went out to the top of the Mount of Olives and he was taken back up into heaven, and the angels told the disciples, "As you see him ascending, likewise you'll see him come." At his second coming, he'll touch down on the top of the Mount of Olives. The earth will split in two, and he'll walk into the city of Jerusalem and he'll establish his kingdom there on the Temple Mount. You know, one of the kicks about going to Israel is to experience, you know, the places where Jesus walked, that you can actually walk where Jesus walked. But to me, there's nothing like standing on top of the Mount of Olives. Because there, not only are you walking where Jesus walked, there you're standing where you know that one day he will stand again. That's pretty thrilling. That just as he left from there, that's where he'll return when he returns to this earth. And here Jesus is sitting, teaching his disciples where one day he's going to be standing and ruling the earth and defeating his enemies. And he teaches them about the end times. The next two chapters, in fact, are known as the Olivet Discourse, fitting because they were taught there on the Mount of Olives. Now, Jesus begins with a question. The disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Now, the sermon that follows has three points. Verses 3 through 14 describe the sign of the end times as they relate to the world at large. Verses 15 through 35 discuss the signs as they directly relate to the nation Israel. And verses 36 through 51 involve the implication of these signs for the church. Jesus had mentioned the destruction of Jerusalem. It was an event that the disciples in their minds associated with the end of the age and the second coming of the Messiah. And they were right. Both Old Testament prophecies, both the Old Testament prophecies and Revelation, they tell us that when Jesus returns, Jerusalem will be under siege. What the disciples didn't understand is that the city would be destroyed many, many times beforehand, before the final battle. As a matter of fact, over the last 3,000 years, Jerusalem has been conquered 38 times. People are still warring over Jerusalem today. And that will be the case when Jesus returns. But Jesus uses the disciples' interest in Jerusalem to answer their question about the end of the age and the signs that will precede His second coming. He begins, "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many.'" Now, toward the end of the age, many false messiahs or false Christs will come. Now, it's interesting that before the life of Jesus, though there was a messianic fever in the air, though there was this expectation for the Messiah, no one was rising up claiming to be Him. There's a reason for that. There were no messianic counterfeits prior to Jesus for the same reason that there's no such thing as a counterfeit $200 bill. Why are there no counterfeit $200 bills? Because they don't make a real $200 bill. You know, before you get a counterfeit, you first have to have the real thing. The real deal has to come along before someone can try and manufacture a copy. Thus, that's why that after Jesus, before Him, there were no false messiahs, but after Him, suddenly, false messiah after false messiah after false messiah, there had been a whole succession of these false Christs. The first one of prominence was in 132 AD. It was a man by the name of Simon Bar Kokhba, a Jewish rebel who led a revolt against Rome. He promised his followers that none of them would be harmed. When he led them into battle, 500,000 Jews were slaughtered. Here's a list of a few more modern false messiahs. Jim Jones. Remember him? Drank the poison Kool-Aid down there in Guyana in 1978. Sun Myung Moon, the Korean founder of the Unification Church, or Moonies. You remember the wacko from Waco? David Koresh. He founded a group called the Branch Davidians. Sergei Torop. Perhaps you've heard of him. He's a former Russian traffic cop who has a 4,000-member cult in Siberia. Benjamin Cream is a nutcase who goes around the world suggesting that a false Christ named Maitreya is alive on earth and awaiting his day of declaration. Jose Luis de Jesus Miranda. He's from Puerto Rico and he's duped about 100,000 followers with claims of being the Christ. And then, of course, in 1997, you remember Marshall Applewhite. He's the guy who convinced 39 followers to commit suicide so they could hitch a ride on the supposed spaceship that was trailing the Hale-Bopp comet. And if the true Messiah, Jesus Christ, tarries, you can be sure that more will follow. Jesus said that there would be false Christs and false messiahs, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. The Norwegian Academy of Sciences has concluded that over the last 3,500 years of world history, there have been 14,531 wars. Out of those 3,600 years, only 292 have been years of peace. That means over the last 3.5 millenniums on this earth, there has been a war in the world 92% of the time. Jesus said there will always be wars and rumors of wars. Look at it this way. There's been 1 minute of peace for every 4 hours of war. Wars and rumors of wars are frequent occurrences. As long as man is in charge of planet Earth, his greed and his selfishness will guarantee that there'll be continual conflict between nations and their citizens. Well, verse 6 says, "See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Jesus is telling us that these false Christs and frequent combat are standard fare on planet Earth. When you see it, don't panic. It's not the end. But nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. Catch this. The Greek word for sorrows, some of you are very familiar with it. It's the word for labor pangs. Labor pangs. You've heard of Braxton Hicks contractions? You know, throughout your pregnancy, you have these false labor pains. They occur irregularly. They're mild contractions. But the childbirth is signaled by an increase in the frequency and force of the contractions. Well, false Christs and military conflicts, they're sort of like Braxton Hicks. I mean, they're going to come. But when their frequency and their intensity begins to peak, that's when you know that the end of the age and the birth of God's kingdom is near. You know, it took until the last century before the earth saw its first world war. Now we've seen two. And for the last 60 years, we've been sitting on the verge of the third world war. Did you know that more people have died in the last century than in any other time in history? The world today is armed to the teeth. Weapons of mass destruction, they're all over the place. More powerful weapons in the hands of more radical people. Did you know there are 42 armed conflicts in the world even as we speak? One scientist was asked what weapons will be used in World War III. He replied, "I don't know, but I know what weapons will be used in World War IV. Sticks and stones, because that's all that will be left after World War III. Notice Jesus also mentions the rise of famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Every day in the world, 854 million people go to bed hungry. This is astonishing. 16,000 kids die of hunger-related causes every day. One child dies every 5 seconds because of starvation, malnutrition. Every 3.6 seconds, somewhere on the planet, a person starves to death. Every 3.6 seconds. Hey, famine, it's all around us. And speaking of pestilence, every day there are new reports of drug-resistant strands of new viruses. This past March, the CDC announced a shocking study, shocking for all of us parents. It said that 1 in 4 teenage girls in America now admit to having a sexually transmitted disease. Unbelievable. Worldwide, 40 million people now live with HIV/AIDS, which results in 3 million deaths annually. There are 400 million cases of malaria and 1 million fatalities every year. The World Summit for Children, a UN organization, reported every day in the world, 1,400 kids die from whooping cough, 4,000 from measles, 2,150 from tetanus, 2,750 from malaria, those are the kids, 11,000 from diarrhea, and 6,000 from pneumonia. I'm telling you, pestilence is everywhere. And earthquakes. I checked this out. In the last 30 days, the world has experienced 409 quakes with a magnitude of 4.0 or greater. In the last 30 days. 13 at a magnitude of 6.0 on the Richter scale. The killer quake that was responsible for 12,000 deaths in southwest China, it was 7.8 on the Richter scale. An underwater earthquake is what triggered last year's killer tsunami in Indonesia. Hey, catch this. What do Oregon, Indiana, southern England, Japan, China, Trinidad, Chile, the West Bank, Israel, Jordan, Iowa, Peru, Nevada, the Philippines, and Hawaii have in common? Do you think we covered it? What do all these places have in common? They've all been rocked by big earthquakes in just the last few years. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the 1980s saw 47 significant earthquakes. The 1990s recorded 57 such earthquakes. But from January 1, 2000 until now, the USGS has recorded 109 earthquakes measuring 7.0 or better on the Richter scale. There's been an obvious increase of earthquakes in strange places. Several years ago, Tim LaHaye, you know who Tim LaHaye is, he's the author of the Left Behind series. He was speaking at a Rotary Club meeting in San Diego. He said that for the first 15 minutes of his gospel presentation, the people were completely uninterested. His gospel message was being met with great boredom. That's when an earthquake hit. He said right there in the banquet hall as he was talking, suddenly an earthquake hit. The table started shaking, the walls started rattling, the china started bouncing on top of the plates. It was amazing. He said for a few seconds there, great fear and panic filled the room. LaHaye said that after the earthquake, it was amazing how much more interested people became in his message. Hey, perhaps this is why the last days we'll see more and more earthquakes. God wants to wake people up and help them listen to his message. Wars and rumors of wars, false Christs, they're to be expected over the centuries. It's going to be standard fare. But when wars begin to expand and intensify on a global scale, and with earthquakes and pestilences and famine increase, that's when you know that the beginning of sorrows has come. Well, what comes after that? But the Great Tribulation. God begins to judge the planet. And as he does, the world takes out its anger on God's people, the Jews. This is what's going to happen when God begins to pour out his judgments on the earth. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. In the Great Tribulation, this final 7-year period, we'll talk about that in a minute, the world will see another Holocaust. He says here, they will deliver you up to tribulation. Who's he talking to? He's talking to Jews. The disciples, the first disciples, were all Jews. Right now, the United States stands by Israel as pretty much her only ally. And hopefully we will remain a consistent ally. But how long that support will be sustained remains to be seen. One day, the day will come when the United States will withdraw her support of Israel and join in the Antichrist worldwide campaign to exterminate the Jews. They'll take you up. You'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended. They will betray one another and will hate one another. You know, the day is coming when allegiances and treaties among nations will all break down. Intrigue and backstabbing and deception will be the foreign policy of all nations. Honor and ethics and honesty will become relics of the past. And then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Even in the Great Tribulation, spiritual deception will reach unprecedented levels. When the Holy Spirit's light and love through His church is removed from this world, all hell will break loose. Darkness will rule the roost. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Cold-bloodedness and ruthlessness and violence and cruelty will even become more commonplace on this planet.
Our greatest calling in life is to be more like Jesus. And the Gospels are the single best place to learn more about how our Savior lived on this earth. Studying the Gospels gives us examples of how to live by the power of God's Spirit. Each day, Pastor Sandy will be teaching through the Gospel of Matthew with hopes that we'll grow to be more like Jesus. This has been another edition of Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. He's the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, we're sure that today's message in Matthew has blessed and encouraged you in your walk with Jesus Christ. Maybe you'd like to review this message again, or perhaps a family member or friend has come to mind today. Log on to sandyadams.org and click on the radio program option in the main menu. There you'll find today's message. All you need to do is remember today's date and log on to sandyadams.org. Or you can give us a call here at the church. Our phone number is 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. Someone is standing by to talk with you. Again, just mention today's date and we'll send you the full-length CD. Next time, Pastor Sandy will continue taking us verse by verse through the Gospel of Matthew. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, we want to say thank you for tuning in, and may God bless you.